ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 27th of March. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. First to the bridge collapse in Baltimore in the United States. People are still missing after a container ship crashed into it, causing the structure to buckle, break up and collapse. The crew of the container ship Dali issued a mayday call just before impact, and Baltimore police have released a radio recording of their efforts to immediately close the bridge just before the early morning collision.
One of you guys on the south side, one of you guys on the north side, hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering. So until you get that under control, we got to stop all traffic.
213 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Everybody. The whole bridge just collapsed.
Baltimore is one of the biggest ports in the United States. It's been shut down as a result of the incident, with the US President Joe Biden pledging full support. Our North America correspondent Barbara Miller is in Baltimore.
Well, we know this incident took place about 1:30 in the morning local time, and a large cargo ship which was departing the port of Baltimore crashed into the Key Bridge. This is a bridge several kilometres long, and there's a footage of this incident. Really within seconds, the entire bridge collapses into the water. Now, authorities say shortly before the crash, there was an emergency call from the ship, and the crew said that they had lost power. In fact, if you look at the footage just before the crash, you can see the lights on that ship flickering. Now, there's been some confusion about how many people might have been on the bridge at the time. Authorities now saying that because of that emergency call from the ship, they were able to stop the flow of traffic onto the bridge. But they say that at least 8 workers, construction workers or repair workers, were on the bridge. 2 of those people are now off the bridge, one of them in hospital in a serious condition, and 6 of those workers still unaccounted for. And it's not clear whether there are other possible potential victims, waiting for updates from authorities to really clarify that issue.
An investigation's now underway, and clearly there are big ramifications for what happened.
Yeah, and authorities very quick to say that they have ruled out terrorism. The FBI is here in Baltimore, one of many agencies who have rushed to the scene. We're just beyond what was the up ramp to this bridge, and you can see mangled bits of the bridge sticking out of the water. But this was a major thoroughfare, a major East Coast artery, people traveling up and down from DC, for example, up to New York, and also a major port. This is the major port in the US for the import and export of cars, and thousands of jobs are also tied up here. So we've heard from President Biden already, who's acknowledged the jobs and the industry associated with this port, the president promising to move heaven and earth to try and get the port up in operation. Of course, no one's giving any timeline for that. And the president saying that he wants to use federal funds to try and get this bridge rebuilt. But of course, for the moment, although there's really very little hope for the people who are missing, this is still an active search scene. Choppers in the air, one over just now, and many, many boats in that water trying to locate those who were on the bridge at the time of this terrible incident.
Barbara Miller there. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been left in a legal limbo, with Britain's High Court delaying a decision on whether he can appeal his extradition to the United States. The US wants Mr. Assange to face court on more than 18 charges related to the release of classified military documents more than a decade ago. But the British judges took an unexpected step, asking the US for assurances before they delivered their judgment. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins has more. It was expected to be a decisive moment in Julian Assange's long-running court battle to fight extradition to the US, but instead, it's more waiting. After 2 days of hearings last month, 2 High Court judges have asked the US to provide further assurances before they consider granting the 52-year-old leave to appeal. Washington must make guarantees on 3 points: that Assange is not prejudiced at trial or sentenced because of his nationality, that Assange can rely on the US Constitution's First Amendment right to free speech, and that the death penalty is not imposed if he's convicted.
His wife, Stella Assange, spoke outside the Royal Courts of Justice moments after this decision was filed.
What the courts have done have been to invite a political intervention from the United States to send a letter saying it's all okay. I find this astounding. 5 years into this case, the United States has managed to show the court that their case remains an attack on press freedom, an attack on Julian's life.
The United States has 3 weeks to respond. The US Department of Justice is not commenting on this ruling. All parties are expected to gather before the court again on May 20. Julian Assange's legal counsel, Jen Robinson, says they will fight against US assurances.
This case is completely unprecedented. It's not clear the US will offer the assurances. We say there's no satisfactory assurance to protect Julian from the risk of serious violations of his First Amendment and due process rights if he's returned to the if he's extradited to the United States. So Amnesty International says they're not worth the paper they're written on. We agree. And it's yet to be seen whether the US will even offer these assurances.
In 2021, the UK's High Court ruled that Julian Assange should be extradited, dismissing claims that his poor mental health meant he might take his own life in a US jail. The British Supreme Court upheld that decision in 2022, and then Home Secretary Priti Patel confirmed his extradition order. He'll now have to wait another 2 months before he finds out if his legal options have run out in the UK, but his team have flagged they'll then apply for an injunction at the European Court of Human Rights. This is Isabella Higgins in London reporting for AM.
Barrister and writer Greg Barnes, SC, is an advisor to the Assange campaign. He joined me earlier. Greg Barnes, the British judge's request for assurances from another court in another country, how unusual is that?
Well, it's a fairly unusual decision because normally an extradition request would be approved or not approved. And certainly when you're getting leave to appeal, where a court says you've got an arguable case, reasonable prospects of success, it would normally go to a full appeal. So it's certainly an unusual move, but of course this is an unusual case.
And the court also wants assurances the death penalty won't apply here, and by including the US Secretary of State in the request. The British court seems to be asking for guarantees the United States government won't proceed with new charges if Mr. Assange is extradited.
Well, certainly the United States is now on the hook, as it were, when it comes to giving these assurances. And if they don't give the assurances, then there will be leave to appeal for Julian. But the real issue is this, that there shouldn't be a case. This shouldn't be a case of diplomatic assurances. This should be a case in which the United States says the case is coming to an end, because it is an attack on freedom of the press. You've got a person who's been effectively detained now for 12 years, and it sets a very dangerous precedent. So it's not a matter of giving assurances. It's a matter of saying that there's no public interest in this case being pursued.
Historically, have foreign nationals enjoyed the same rights as US citizens before American courts of law?
Well, look, I think it depends. And certainly in the case of Assange, we have evidence which was revealed by Yahoo News, I think back in 2021, which indicated senior members of the CIA looked at assassinating him. We also know from evidence given in these proceedings that the United States detention system, prison system, is notoriously harsh and in many cases amounts to torture. So in the case of Julian Assange, you could not guarantee in any way that he would get a fair trial.
Aside from this case, the Wall Street Journal reported last week that high-level talks were happening in secret about the US seeking a plea deal to allow Mr. Assange to walk free if he admits to a misdemeanor. Have you managed to find out anything about that?
Well, look, we're not making any comment on that, and we note the comment from Barry Pollock, who's Julian's US lawyer, indicating that the status quo remained.
Should the Australian government be doing more? It's obvious that at high levels they are trying to do something.
Well, it should be doing more, and they should be putting the foot on the pedal, as it were, now, given that this case is coming to an end one way or another in the United Kingdom, and Julian faces real risks in the United States. This is an Australian citizen, and an Australian citizen whom the vast majority of Australians think should come home, and the case against him should end. And we'd certainly continue to urge the Albanese government to up its efforts and become more aggressive in its efforts with the Biden administration.
Greg Barnes, thanks for talking to AM.
Thank you very much, Sabra.
Barrister and writer Greg Barnes, SC, who's an advisor to the Julian Assange campaign. In Canberra, some parliamentarians and advocates are angry and dismayed that the federal government's rushing legislation through Parliament to make it easier to deport non-citizens. The proposed new laws are being described by some as dangerous and unnecessary, but are set to pass Parliament today, only a day after they were introduced. Here's political reporter Monty Bovell.
The federal government's rush to push through changes to Australia's migration law is a red flag for advocates. Samati Verma is the legal director at the Human Rights Law Centre.
A telltale sign of a bad law is when it's rushed through Parliament, precluding any possibility of public critique or scrutiny. These are bad laws, and that's why they're being made on the fly the way that they are.
The new laws would give Immigration Minister Andrew Giles extraordinary powers that would make it easier to deport non-citizens. They would allow the Commonwealth to hand out a mandatory prison sentence of up to 5 years to non-citizens who refuse to cooperate with authorities working to deport them. The government would also be able to block visas for people coming from a country that's not accepting the people Australia is trying to deport.
What we're doing with this piece of legislation, this important piece of legislation, is to fill a very significant loophole.
It's not only angered refugee and human rights advocates, but also many MPs and senators who are shocked with how fast the changes have been pushed through. On Tuesday night, during a Senate committee hearing, the government was accused of rushing the legislation because of an upcoming High Court case. It involves an Iranian man who is refusing to be deported for fear of persecution at home.
The government clearly thinks they're going to lose that High Court case and be ordered to release the guy.
Luke Beck is a professor in constitutional law at Monash University. He says if the Commonwealth were to lose that case, it could see a cohort of immigration detainees released into the community.
And so what they're doing is they're coming up with a workaround method of keeping him locked up and people like him. So instead of locking him up in immigration detention because they're trying to deport him, if he refuses to apply for the travel documents, they'll be able to prosecute him in the criminal courts and have him sentenced to regular criminal jail.
In the late night hastily convened Senate hearing, Home Affairs officials were questioned on why the legislation was so urgent. They insist it's not driven by the looming High Court case. The Secretary of the Department is Stephanie Foster.
It's a fundamental tenet of an effective migration system that we are able to enforce removal of people who shouldn't be here.
Here's Professor Beck again.
When you rush legislation, you run the risk of getting things wrong, getting things not quite right, leading to unintended consequences. Sometimes a little bit more slow and steady will end up winning the race.
The legislation passed the House of Representatives on Tuesday, but the government wants it to pass the Senate today, before Parliament rises until mid-May.
Monty Bovell reporting. There are warnings a generation of kids is growing up economically cut off from the benefits they should be enjoying as a result of living in a wealthy country like Australia. The Child Social Exclusion Index from the Uniting Care and University of Canberra has found close to a million children under the age of 15 have the odds heavily stacked against them when it comes to getting a fair go in life. Nick Grimm reports.
Lindsay Desmonds knows how many children face a bleak future unless they're given a helping hand. She runs the SEED program in Victoria, which aims to offer some a better start at life.
And the program provides early childhood education and care to babies and toddlers who have experienced complex trauma, significant family stress, or social disadvantage, to reduce the impacts of children living with toxic stress, particularly before they start school.
How would you describe the scale of the problem?
I would say it's huge.
And the kids helped by the SEED program might still be luckier than others growing up right now in hundreds of communities across Australia. New research has found that one in six children under the age of 15 are excluded from the benefits other kids their ages take for granted. And it's not just growing up poor that sets them apart.
Child disadvantage, I think, is not necessarily captured by child income poverty only. I think that is quite obvious.
Professor Rihanna Moranti from the University of Canberra's School of Economics, Politics and Society is the lead author of the research known as the Child Social Exclusion Index.
We do usually traditionally measure child disadvantage through income poverty, right? Because that is based on income, and then we look at how many 10%, for example, children that are below that poverty line, right? But with this one, we capture other aspects of disadvantage. There are also children who are not income poor, but they are also still at the risk of social exclusion or experiencing other types of disadvantage.
It's one of those kind of sticky or what we call wicked social problems.
That's Clairwyn Little, National Director of Uniting Care Australia, which collaborated on the Child Social Exclusion Index. It's found 880,000 children meet a range of criteria for social exclusion, whether it's growing up in a family where no parent is in paid work or completed year 12 at school, or living in areas where outdoor recreational, sporting and cultural facilities simply do not exist.
They may not have access to safe and affordable housing. They don't have access to quality health care. Their educational outcomes are poorer than others. They don't feel connected to their community. They may not be able to participate in sport or other recreational activities. And essentially, their quality of life and their outcomes are poorer than other children.
Yeah, what are the implications of a generation of children growing up who don't feel a connection with the wider fabric of society?
Well, essentially, early experiences of social exclusion can carry lifelong impacts of disadvantage, which is why we have to take a close look at how to give our kids the best chance to thrive.
Clairwyn Little is the National Director of Uniting Care Australia, Nick Grimm reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. A government plan to partly fund a big ritzy new stadium in Hobart became one of the most contested issues of the Tasmanian election on the weekend. Today, Cos Samaris, the director of polling company Redbridge Group, on why voters have had enough of paying for sporting venues. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.